Turns out that word, transitory, it did not mean what we thought it meant. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the last day of September, also the last day of the third quarter. By the way, good as always to have you along. So look, a couple of things just off the bat here to get us going. Number one, Congress has fulfilled its most basic responsibility of keeping the government of the United States up and running. Yes, it was touch and go there for a while. Both the House and the Senate have passed a continuing resolution funding things until December the 3rd. So another 8 weeks or so, we get to do the shutdown dance all over again. Infrastructure, item number two, is a different story. Democrats are still negotiating amongst themselves over what exactly to vote on and when. It's complicated is something of an understatement. Not complicated is item three, the approaching debt limit. October the 18th or thereabouts, said Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen today, is the drop-dead date. Nothing new to report on that. Sitting right next to the Treasury Secretary today, I mean like, you know, 6 or 8 feet next to, anyway, it was Fed Chair Jay Powell. The pair were back for their second day of testimony on Capitol Hill about all things economic. And perhaps not surprisingly, inflation came up. And why? And what could be done about it? And Powell said, weedy though this answer will sound, he said it's a, quote, function of supply-side bottlenecks over which we have no control, end of quote. Supply chain for the bazillionth time. He also said, Powell did, that inflation's going to clear up. Eventually. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, it has taken longer to clear up than anybody, including one Jerome Powell, predicted.
As the pandemic wore on, many consumers were flush with cash and eager to buy stuff. Then global supply chains hit bottlenecks because reopening isn't smooth, and prices spiked as buyers competed for limited supplies. Now, says Adam Posen at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, the Fed has recognized these problems are likely to be with us for a while.
The so-called transitional inflation coming out of the pandemic was probably going to last longer than the less than a year the Fed seemed to be forecasting.
The Delta variant is still raging, hitting particularly hard at factories and ports in Southeast Asia that send container ships full of computer chips and consumer goods to the U.S. But
that's probably about as bad as supply chain interruption gets. It's probably the worst has already happened on this front, and it's going to unwind and get better from here.
So how long might it take for supply chains to get ironed out and meet business and consumer demand to take upward pressure off of prices? Nyree Hinton tracks food, apparel, and other consumer staples at Third Bridge, and he says it'll be well into next year.
It's probably going to be a Q1, a Q2, and a Q3, and a Q4 issue.
These supply chain problems and price spikes could turn out to be transitory, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics.
If it's the pandemic is still raging, causing people to be sick and not going to work and shutting down factories and Chinese ports, when the pandemic goes away, these problems will go away.
On the other hand,
if the price spikes and inflation and shortages are happening, even though the pandemic is winding down, and I'm wrong, then yeah, I think at that point expectations could shift even before, you know, 2023 or 2024.
Setting up higher inflationary expectations and forcing the Fed to raise interest rates before the economy has fully recovered. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, hey, what do you know? Looks like my favorite five-syllable word is back. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got the regular Thursday report on first-time claims for unemployment benefits this morning, up again last week. Third week in a row, by the way, going in the wrong direction. Not by a lot, to be clear, and still close to the pandemic lows we hit at the beginning of the month. But I'm obliged to remind you here that close to pandemic lows is still a long way from back to normal. And a new report from AARP shows just how not normal the labor market is right now for women at their mid-career and beyond. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
The survey of women 40 to 65 found more than 40% had experienced some work interruption during the pandemic. And for those who were still jobless in June, nearly 70% had been unemployed for 6 months or more.
It's pretty scary.
Susan Weinstock is vice president of financial resiliency at AARP.
There's so many implications down the line for jobs, for savings, for retirement, for financial stability.
In most recessions, older workers have a harder time finding a job and often end up with lower pay when they do, says Monique Morrissey at the Economic Policy Institute.
This is not a typical recession.
Because of the pandemic, older workers may also have health concerns about returning to work. And women particularly have been affected by disruptions to school and caregiving.
People who are caring for young children, caring for their spouses, and caring for parents.
30% of the women surveyed reported taking care of a child or grandchild, and 1 in 10 were caring for both a child and an adult. The numbers were even higher for Black and Latinx women. C. Nicole Mason heads the Institute for Women's Policy Research.
Many women of color relied, during the pandemic and even before, on familial care.
Older women of color disproportionately lost jobs during the pandemic and may face discrimination in the labor market even if they can return, she says. Ofer Sharon is a sociologist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
I think many people have the wrong perception that right now it's easy to get a job.
So if you can't, unlike during the height of the pandemic or even the Great Recession, he says, it's more likely to carry a stigma. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We turn now to a woman who's been working her land this whole pandemic. Corn and soybeans is what April Hemis farms in Iowa, where it's just about harvest time right now. So we called her up today to see how things are going. And the way these things work on our end is that the producer gets on the phone first to get things all set up, make sure it's all good. And then I get on the line, which today is when I overheard this.
I don't know what Kai wants to talk about. He never really has a choice. I just kind of carry the conversation, so.
I'm sitting right here, you know. I'm sitting right here. Oh, my goodness. Well, look, since we're off and running already, how you been? It's been a while since we've chatted. Things all right?
Yeah, it's been a lot of crap has gone down. I had to replant 80% of my soybeans because it frosted off. I started harvest, and we've been in an extreme drought the whole year. So.
All right, hold on. There's a lot in there. Can we back up to replant the soybeans? How does that even work?
So, you know how we farmers love to sit in tractors.
Yeah.
May 29th or 30th, we got pretty cold. Not hard frost, but enough to kill my soybeans. And they had been in the ground a month. So I had to get more soybeans and go back out and replant most of them that frosted off in the low-lying areas and stuff. So,
wow.
Yeah.
And obviously that's going to cost you money, right?
Yeah, it cost me money. We have insurance to cover, like, gas, you know, and then usually the seed companies will give you replant seed, but it's not, you know, it's not what I wanted. It's not what I had planted. But anyway, it's mostly time in the tractor, but it's still at a cost. So,
yeah, let me back you out of the tractor for a minute and talk big picture. Couple of things. Number one, given the drought and the freeze and the heat and the flooding, I haven't ever asked you about climate change. And I wonder where that ranks on your list of things that keep you up at night.
So I am a farmer that says, yes, things have changed. Does it keep me up at night? No, because, well, my crop depends on the weather. So we're coming out of an extreme drought this year. I had 8 inches of rain the whole growing season when I was supposed to have 22 normally. And then end of August, we started getting rain. Actually, I'm not out in the fields today because we got rain this morning. So,
you can't farm in the rain? What?
No.
You don't have like windshield wipers on the combines? That's kind of a serious question.
No, it is. I know. And so I have two rules with windshield wipers. Never plant with the windshield wiper on and never harvest with the windshield wiper
on. All right. Okay.
Because bad things happen. You plug up a planter with mud and then combine the silks on the corn, get wet, and then they plug the sieve up. And then I'm talking farmer now.
All right. Big picture topic number two. China, global trade, access to that market. I mean, where does that stand now for you and sort of bigger picture for the rest of your industry?
Exactly. It's still very frustrating because what people forget is that the tariffs are still on there.
Yep.
And they're not negotiating. They're not doing anything unless they're doing something that they're not telling the rest of us, but that's the frustrating part.
But wait, I mean, look, you've been around the block a couple of times. You know people. Iowa's not that big a place. The Secretary of Agriculture happens to be a former governor of the state of Iowa, Secretary Vilsack. You could probably get him on the phone.
Oh yeah, yeah, I have direct dial. No, I don't. I've been on several Zoom meetings with he and Ambassador Tai lately.
The trade and representative, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then their focus, their question to us as a seed committee for trade was, how can we get labor into the trade deals? And, you know, that's very frustrating because it's got nothing to do with trade. So, you know, we need to know a plan from them, what they really want, and then you can start moving on.
And you're not getting that. Here we are, eight, whatever it is, months into this administration. You're not getting it.
I don't feel I'm getting it. Yeah. No, not at all.
All right. I'll let you go. But last question. What do farmers do when it rains if they can't, you know, farm?
Well, we drive our Rolls Royces, of course. Okay. I had to get that in there, Kai.
Oh,
last time I was on there, our prices had gone, well, doubled.
Know.
Remember? Well, they're down a bit. But I'm looking, actually, my soybeans are coming out better than I thought they would.
Oh, that's good.
And is a little more disappointing than I thought it would. So, yeah.
There you go. April Hemmings, she's our farmer in Iowa. Lets me drive the tractor every now and then when I go out there. April, thanks a bunch. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
Coming up.
It was like the floodgates had been opened.
What happens when childcare is finally available? First, though, let's do the numbers. My favorite five-syllable word, volatility. The Dow Industrial is down 546 today, 1.5%, 33,843. S&P 500 off 51 points, about 1.1%. NASDAQ down 63, 0.4%. 14,448. Recent survey by the National Association of Business Economics showed a lot of business executives are less optimistic about the economy in fear that vaccination holdouts could stall or even reverse the progress made. Respondents expected real GDP growth for the year to come in at a median 5.6%. We'll tell you more about that later on in the program. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note. Remember I always say watch the Treasury yield? Down 1.49% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. More companies, as we know, are requiring employees to be vaccinated. Cities and counties and some private businesses are requiring proof of vaccination to get into sports stadiums or concert halls or restaurants or what have you. And that verification process has become an important part of work and play in this economy. And so, as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, it has become a business opportunity in and of itself.
Here in New York, you have to show proof of vaccination to do basically anything fun. Some restaurants and concert venues will accept a photo of the card. Others ask you to download a specific app. And if your phone's dead, no fun for you. So I've been living life on the edge, carrying around my paper card, which is annoyingly too big to fit into my wallet. Why does it have to be this way?
It just is a reflection of our fractured system of public health governance.
Josh Michaud is with the Kaiser Family Foundation. He says, like mask mandates, vaccine certification falls to cities and states, so companies are stepping in. Clear, the membership program known for its express security lines at airports and stadiums, has free vaccine verification on its app. Catsby Perrin is Executive VP of Growth.
We think there are lots of other applications where there are friction in your life. So now you're not only your vaccination record, but you're also your ticket.
Apple and Android devices store vaccine cards, too. It's all about the growing digital wallet. Amena Ali is CEO of Airside, a passport app that also stores vaccine cards.
Because of the pandemic, there's been this acceleration in the shift to digital, and that certainly is going to impact identities.
Airside is looking to expand into storing credit reports and proof of income to pass on to landlords. And that's where the money is, not just with users like you and me, but companies that will pay for reliable verification systems. Here's Kaiser's Josh Michaud again.
There can be a wide gulf in terms of the actual, you know, stringency and the ultimate public health impact.
Michaud says a vaccine policy is only as effective as the system that verifies it. In New York, I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Back in the phase of the pandemic, maybe we just got through the peak of it nationally anyway, but the part of it where hospitals and thus healthcare workers are getting slammed. And some of those healthcare workers, nurses in particular, are slamming the door on the way out. They're either retiring or just doing something else. And that means the nursing profession needs reinforcements like never before. And there are some signs that nursing school enrollment is picking up, as Blake Farmer reports now from WPLN in Nashville.
Molly Ricks is taking notes on her virtual lecture as her three kids entertain themselves, though they interrupt briefly to ask her to check their pulse. Ricks, who lives in Nashville, has a master's degree in early childhood education, but decided to go back to school this fall and change careers.
My nursing program is 16 months, so pretty accelerated.
She says she's interested in working perhaps in a low-income clinic, though she's open to intensive care work. ICUs have taken care of the sickest COVID patients and are now seeing the most urgent nursing shortages.
It doesn't make me scared. It makes me want to go into it more because there's such a shortage. It's a shame that that's what's happening right now. And I mean, I understand why it's happening because it's hard.
Staffing shortages have been enough to cripple some hospitals during the current surge and led to a spike in pay for contract nurses. Mark Vogt leads Galen College, a large nursing school.
We're trying to find people who want to run into the fire, but we're trying to find people who understand that you're really needed.
The for-profit school, owned by hospital chain HCA, just opened new campuses in Austin, Miami, and Nashville, three regions hit hard by the COVID-related hospital capacity constraints.
They've been battling this for a while, so they need some fresh hands and some fresh minds to kind of give them some relief.
Nursing school enrollment nationwide grew last year by more than 5%, despite fears that the pandemic might scare off prospective students. Nursing education could get a $1 billion investment through the Biden administration's Build Back Better Act, but nursing schools are limited in how many more students they can train. That's in part because the hospitals where nurses get hands-on experience are just trying to make sure shifts are getting filled. They have little bandwidth for training a new generation of nurses. Professor Jonathan Mack leads the program at the University of San Diego.
Here we are in a pandemic where nursing schools should be doubling, registered nurses to go to the bedside. But the hospitals, due to the pandemic, and this happened literally overnight, where we were notified, hey, we can't take any students.
The University of San Diego has reduced the size of its newest class, and current students are having to drive as far as 2 hours to get in their required hospital time. Nursing programs across the country have had to find alternatives to the standard clinical experience in a hospital. Instead of logging hours at the bedside, many students have been tapped to run vaccine clinics.
Buenos días. Si quieren tomarse una foto.
At a community event in Nashville, nursing students administer COVID shots and encourage people to post about it on social media. They include some students from Belmont University, where Professor Kathy Taylor runs the nursing school.
Our students gave a lot of vaccines.
They also helped with contact tracing, staffed COVID hotlines, and have had more practice with infection control than any students before, Taylor says. In a way, she says the new hands-on opportunities may result in more well-rounded graduates coming out of this unusual time.
We are already challenged to start to think more about how do we keep patients in a community or a home setting. Those are jobs of the future.
But the jobs so many nurses are leaving are in the intensive care units of hospitals, and schools still project that they won't be graduating enough nurses to meet the hole left by the pandemic. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Schools have mostly reopened for in-person classes this year, but for some parents, the ones with infants and toddlers, their lives are still far from normal, trying to deal with limited capacity at child care centers because of pandemic restrictions, yes, but also staffing shortages. And so we have arrived at today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Millie Pintacci. I am the owner and director of an infant center and preschool in Napa, California, called Le Petit Elephant Nursery and Preschool. We opened our doors on December 14th, 2015, you know, with my infant in tow. And it felt clear to me that this is something that Napa really desperately needed. There were just not even close to enough childcare spots. So we hosted our first open house, and it was like the floodgates had been opened. It was wonderful. It was thrilling. It was terrifying. And we've basically grown since then. We finally had reached full capacity in March of 2020. But when COVID hit, we shut down with the shelter in place. And we basically lost all of that momentum. We had to furlough 32 highly qualified and trained teachers, and all of our families. We had 121 children enrolled with us when we had to close. When we reopened our doors 3 months after the quarantine first began, it was quite devastating. We lost an average of $20,000 to $30,000 a month just being open. We only were able to have about half of the families and about half of our staff that were willing to return and wanting to return. Since then, we continue to try to hire, which has been an extreme challenge for us to find teachers with experience in childcare, as well as the education that is required to be a fully qualified preschool or infant teacher. Our enrollment has increased quite a bit over the last few months, just as I think people have become vaccinated and it feels like things are getting a little bit under control here in California. And so I've started feeling hopeful that, you know, we're going to make it through this. It does feel most days that I'm basically stretched as thin as I can go. It takes quite a lot to be kind of a one-woman show. But this is our family business. This was our nest egg. It feels like we can't fail. We have to make it.
That was Millie Pintacci, owner of Le Petit Elephant, or the Petit Elephant, nursery school and preschool up in Napa, California. You know what I'm going to say now. We cannot do this series without you. So please let us know how your economy is doing, would you? Marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, which will be filed under Incentives Matter. United Airlines now says better than 99% of its 67,000 U.S.-based employees have gotten vaccinated. The incentive, of course, was that the company was going to fire them if they didn't. CEO Scott Kirby says just 320 people have refused and are thus on their way out. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context brought to us by the initials G, D, and P. The Commerce Department gave us its last best guess on economic growth for the second quarter this morning. GDP, by the way, stands for gross domestic product. I should have said that. Anyway, up just a touch from earlier estimates, 6.7% at an annualized rate. Got to point out, though, that Q2 was before Delta really got going. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.